My name's Nora Peel, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Boston Book Festival. It's so great to see such a huge crowd here today. I have a feeling this is going to be a particularly lively session, so I'll keep my remarks short. But I did want to let you all know that as part of our ongoing efforts to keep the BBF free for everyone, we're holding a raffle this year. The winner will receive a brand new cherry red Vespa. Why a Vespa, you ask? Well, mostly because we happened into a free Vespa, thanks to Piaggio Fast Forward, but the pairing seems right, because the Vespa and the book may be the only two things in the world no one has improved upon, despite endless attempts. Anyway, look for our volunteers wearing Vespa t-shirts and find out how you can help support the BBF this year and maybe get a little something for yourself at the same time. And now, without further ado, I'd like to turn things over to our host for this fabulous session, the equally remarkable Meghna Chakrabarty. Thank you.
Thank you all so much. I have to say that every year that Boston Book Festival happens and I get so kindly invited to moderate one of these sessions, I am always humbled and astounded by the fact that they're always full. So I think that says a lot about Greater Boston. But first of all, so this is a panel that's called Strong Women. Men and women out there today, are we feeling strong? That was a little wan. Let's try it again. Are you feeling strong? That's better.
Right.
I'm all about projection and living in the moment. But anyway, so strong women. I've got three incredible strong women up here on the stage with me. We're going to talk a lot about a variety of things in terms of what strong means. But let me introduce them to you first and foremost. Lindy West. You know her from her writing, and I should say her work on the radio as well, in a number of places. But she's also author of the book *Shrill Notes from a Loud Woman*.
Word.
Yep. Everyone's gonna get a lot of applause today. Sitting next to her is Lovey Ajayi. Blogger extraordinaire and author of *I'm Judging You* as well. And sitting next to her is Maura Weigel. She's author of *Labor of Love: The Invention of Dating*. Terrific book. All right, so let's first start off. By the way, we will be taking questions. We'll chat for a little bit, and then we'll take questions. I'll let you know when we'll open the floor, and you'll see there's two mics there. I'll give you the whole rigmarole about keeping it short and asking a question a little bit later. But first of all, okay. So when we say strong women, given all that's been happening in the world and domestically, what does strong mean to you in this moment right now? Just jump in.
Strong for me right now is calling out men on their bullshit. There's a lot of it. So, of course, since last week, we saw that video, and I've seen women come out the woodworks to tell their stories of how that's less the exception and more the rule in terms of how they've been dealt with. Like, every woman has a story of being touched in a way that's inappropriate by somebody who you didn't give consent to. So I think strong women have came out to share their stories and be vulnerable in this moment to show that we can't stand that anymore.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot of resilience to go through that process to, what the other narrative that we've seen this week is women coming out and telling these stories and, you know, men telling them that they're lying. I mean, we have this dual narrative where it's, why didn't you come forward sooner and tell your story? And then when you do, you're called a liar and you're asked to relive it over and over and over again. And so there's a lot of, you have to be really tough to be vulnerable. And I think that setting those boundaries and holding them is what I see as strength right now. It just takes a tremendous amount of it.
Well, Lindy, can you talk a little bit more about that? Because in your book, you actually write a lot about all the people you've had to take on and call out, essentially, including your own boss, at one time, which I'm sure, and you know, he's not just an average boss either. Mm-hmm. I mean, Dan Savage is a person to be reckoned with. I mean, can you tell us, like, personally from your experience, like, how do you gather the strength? How do you confront the moment?
Sure. Yeah. So in my book, for people who haven't read it, there's a long story about a sort of ongoing disagreement that I had with my boss at the time, who is Dan Savage, who's a popular sex columnist and author and pundit, who I love, who's amazing, and who I learned a lot from. Like, he taught me how to be a writer and how to communicate, and also sort of how to navigate the world of media. So I owe him a lot, and I also, that made it really difficult to have this ongoing disagreement with him about the way that he was writing, and this is 10 years ago, writing and talking about fat people in America. So what I ended up doing was writing a public blog post yelling at him while I was still employed there. And because that was sort of how we handled things at the paper. We had public confrontations, and everything was transparent, and we talked about things in the open. And so, I just didn't know any other way to do it. And it was, when it's something that matters to you, and, I felt pretty secure in my job. I didn't feel like, I was pretty popular. I didn't feel like they were going to fire me. And that's a privilege. I had this safe footing. And it was something that meant a lot to me personally, that affected my life, and that I knew affected the lives of a lot of our readers. And it just felt like a responsibility to use that platform and that relative safety and privilege to set a boundary and say, this is unacceptable. I do not, I won't stand for being talked about in this degrading way in my workplace by someone who I consider a friend. And I think that a lot of people don't have that level of freedom and don't have that privilege. A lot of us are trapped in jobs where we're not treated well, or in relationships where we're not treated well, and there's a lot at stake.
Yeah.
There's a lot at risk if you stand up for yourself. And so, having always been, in a good situation where I felt safe sticking up for myself and for people who look like me and for people who I think need defending, it feels like an obligation to use that, right? To use that safety to be as loud as possible.
Right. Well, so Maury, some thoughts on that? Because I've got also, I could ask you specifically about how your book approaches this issue, but you...
No, I think I loved listening. Can you hear me? Is it not? Pull it up. I'm like, there we go. Oh, that's much better. No, I was going to say a thing I've been thinking about a lot this week and listening to you both speak, where you've built these incredible kinds of communities and audiences online. I've just been thinking a lot about how much strength is collective as well. And to just go into it immediately, I think the spectacle of watching Hillary as this sort of lone woman in the debate at the beginning of the week, and this sort of sense that I felt, and I think a lot of women I spoke to felt, of just like sickness at the kind of physical intimidation she was receiving. There's something about how I think something that really excites me about a form of strength I'm seeing among young women now is that it is collective, and it's like there's something so scary about being the lone woman, the lone strong woman. And I think there's this really, like a sense that's building online and in certain kinds of counter publics, alternative publics, of strong womanhood being a collective endeavor that feels really exciting. Yeah. So
you want to talk about that, Livy, a little bit?
It's been covered.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so what about this idea that, I'm thinking about what the First Lady said in New Hampshire a little earlier this week about, an incredible speech. There was a part where she was talking about strong men, and that in order for us to feel that collective strength in mm-hmm. terms of supporting women, we have to be very specific in what our definition of strong manhood is, strong masculinity is. And do you have a thought about that?
I mean, strong masculinity is not machismo. I think strong masculinity is masculinity that doesn't put itself in the box where you have to be caveman. I think I find strength in men who can be vulnerable and can show what manhood looks like when they're hurt or sad or any emotion outside of the angry. And even anger does not have to be shown in like rage and hawking out. So right now, what I consider strong men are the men who have the wherewithal to stand behind women, not even beside us, behind us, in especially these moments where we're being triggered and re-traumatized by a man who's on the main stage who takes himself to be a strong man in the very cartoon version. So right now, I think it's imperative for men to show their strength by showing emotion and showing that they're affected by this too, because here's the thing, if women are up in arms about one thing that a man said, you'll call us emotional. But I need men to get emotional on our behalves. That, for me, is strength. Not them being like, well, I'm just going to be here lifting up heavy weights, like CrossFitting. That's not strength. Like, we don't need that. I can hire a mover. I don't need you for that. I need men to be vulnerable right now and with us along the way. And I will say that I've seen men be vulnerable with us this week. But I also feel like part of that is problematic. Because it took him literally saying, I will grab her by her body for men to be like, oh my God, that's not okay. It's like grabbing their face to be like, this was wrong. But for the times when it's not that blatant, we're still going to need them to get emotional on our behalf. Like when it's the times when it's the microaggressions, like when we're in rooms and we say something and it takes a man to validate it for another man to give it some strength. So I'm hoping it doesn't take the blatant, I'm going to grab her, for men to finally be like, I'm going to listen. That's not okay. Because that was a gift almost, because that doesn't happen most of the time. Now they're like, oh man, so does that happen to you guys? Really? We've been telling you this for like a long time? And it takes a recorded tape with video and audio as clear as day for you guys to be like, oh man, that's jacked up. You guys have it rough.
And I mean, you also hear on the tape Billy Bush sitting there being like, you know, like, and that's not an anomaly.
Right.
I mean, regular men sit there, and I know this is true. Come on, because I've overheard conversations between men that I know and who I consider friends, where they talk about women in a degrading way, and people whose politics are aligned with mine do not speak up.
Yep.
Because it's easier to just go along with it and laugh, and because to some degree, this subjugation, like dehumanization of women, is built in, and even good men think of women to some degree as an item for them to use.
Do you really think that? I'm going to stand in defense of good men. I think there are a lot of men out there who do not objectify women, but at this point in time, maybe
okay, well,
their
that's
voices
also,
are not being heard.
That's also something that's been a constant refrain since this tape came out. It's just man after man after man coming to me and being like, I'm not that guy. I don't care. Show me that you're not that guy by doing something. And even politically, like if you've been letting women bear the brunt of women's issues like abortion for decades because that's our deal, then you've been affirming the idea that, like, you've been sitting there and letting this notion that women's bodies are public property just go unchecked and left us to fight it. So
and
I need more
defense.
Action. I need you to prove to me that you're not that guy if you're not that guy.
And I'm sorry, but the good man defense is a weak one. Because here's the thing. You know how denigration flourishes? Is because within peers, they're saying it's okay for it to happen. The fact that they've been around people for years, for decades, who've allowed them to speak like that. The good men who've been quiet in the rooms have been the men who've allowed this to flourish. Because if you have that one guy in the locker room who's saying that awful thing, and then 20 good men are just like, oh, you're allowing that to live. You're giving it air. So you know what? The good men don't get off on this. They do not get the, well, I don't do that. You know what? You are a part of a system that privileges you as a male. Your job should be to be anti-sexist, not just to be the guy who's not physically contributing to sexism. So the idea of good men is a cop-out, first of all. Second of all, it's not even true for most men. I'm sorry. I love men. I am dating one. He's a good man. But here's the thing. Things like that, like systems that exist that denigrate one marginalized group, do not exist just because there are three bad ones. It exists because it allows, it has space to exist. So the good men, now's the time for you to show you're a good man by actually fighting against that, as opposed to being thinking, because you're not actively giving words out there that's like slurs to women, that you're not contributing. You are. You exist. Your friends are saying horrible things on Facebook all the time, and you're sitting there being like, scroll past it. No. If you're good, if you're a good man, fight with us. Otherwise, you're not a good man. I'm sorry.
And I think what you were saying earlier about emotion too and vulnerability is so key, and that it's like we have, it's funny, I think about this in dating too, but we have these inherited models of sort of toxic masculinity that are predicated on humiliating women, and where emotion is sort of a source of embarrassment or unmanliness. And it seems as if, you know, I'm more concerned, frankly, about how that hurts women, but I think it's bad for men too. And it's like why people sit there silent is because it seems embarrassing somehow to show, you know, upset or discomfort, to sort of deviate from this heterosexist, patriarchal, it's like two gender ideal that constructs men this way. So I think what you were saying about emotion is like really key to making men more comfortable being good or actively good in that way.
I will say something happened recently, yesterday actually. The Nigerian president, he gets asked a question about his wife, and he's like, I want to make sure she stays in the kitchen. And I'm seeing discussions in Facebook from men who were like, he was just joking. How is that a joke? That's like, and people were being like, he was just joking. It's not that big of a deal. Those are the good men.
I don't agree. I do think there's something to be said about living a decent life and treating other people decently. And those people, those good men, aren't the ones saying he was just joking. That is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about that given the political moment that we're in and the very correct efforts and battles to, you know, on behalf of all marginalized people, whether it's women, people of color, anything, I don't think that it's necessarily entirely productive to marginalize good men in the process.
Okay, I just have to say, like, I'm not saying that every single man on earth actively, consciously objectifies women. I'm saying that we were all raised in the same culture that, as a class, places men above women, and all men absorb that, and some men actively fight against it.
Yep.
But being a good man is something that you do. It's not something that you are. You don't just get to become, like, call yourself a good man and then get a pass. And, you know, I shouldn't have to sit here and say, like, I'm married to a man who's a good man, even though that's true. Like, I shouldn't have to qualify that and, like, you know, defend myself against this charge of man-hating. Not that you told me that I was a man-hater, but people tell me that all the time. And I don't want to have to waste my time being like, no, I love certain men. Here's a list. Because what we're talking about isn't about individual people. It's about, you know, patterns and systems. Yeah. And I just think that every man... Just like as a white person, I have to do this.
Thank you.
I have to place myself consciously, you know, in this system. How am I benefiting? How am I perpetuating it? And do that every day. Yep. Everything that I do, I have to assess, is this perpetuating a toxic system, a racist system, or not? And so that's what I'm saying when I say that all men are complicit in this system, because they are.
Yes.
And good ones are ones who work on it every day, and sometimes still fail, because, you know, I'm sure I make mistakes as a white person, you know, and my duty, my job, is to be aware of that and to do better every day going forward.
I appreciate you for that, because I was going to make that point, too. The idea that just living decently within your own realm is enough is why the world is as it is, because people who've lived decently, just by, I'm going to treat singular people okay, thinking that's enough, is what makes us think we're not contributing to the system that we are part of. As a woman who's straight, if I'm in a room where somebody is being like hateful against LGBT people when I sit there and I'm like, I'm being decent by not contributing to it. If I shut up in that moment, I'm not being decent. I'm not. So here's the thing, like we have to stop living the lowered expectation life that people are living enough by just being themselves and doing nothing else outside of that. I'm sorry. We have to charge people who are privileged. I'm privileged in many ways. I don't have racial privilege, but I have class privilege, sexual orientation privilege, gender identity privilege. My job in the moments when I am in a room where I have the space and I don't have everything to lose is to speak up when something is being said and it's not okay. To just be decent is not enough. And honestly, the power that we have, we're on this stage because we have a certain amount of power. We need to use that and actually be okay with understanding that, yes, to whom much is given, much is required. I can't be up here and be like, God, you guys want me to say stuff about things that have nothing to do with me. Oh, that's not fair. I'm literally on a stage and elevated. Like, who am I to just be like, well, no, I'm going to be decent by just keeping it safe. So I do want to charge men who are in this room. Here's the thing. The fact that you're in this room enough shows that you actually care about the world. Like, you're at a panel called Super Women. So I thank you for being here and listening to us. But please make it a part of yourself and your work to actively fight for women, even when we're not there, to see that this is happening. Even when we're not the ones in the locker room when your boys are saying these things. It's really important that you make it your own business because the people in your lives are being affected by this system. Like, we are walking in rooms, we're walking in on the streets afraid of our own safety. Because men like Trump say things like, I'm going to go grab her by the... Like, what? That's just obscene to me, so... Yeah.
And I think I'm glad we're talking about systems too, because I think part of what to me feels really exciting, I mean, there's a lot that's really depressing about right now. But one thing that feels exciting is I do feel like there are these conversations happening about like intersecting systems of oppression. And it's like, these are not, you know, I feel like when I was growing up in like the 90s or the early 2000s, people would say like, oh, you're a feminist, but you're wearing lipstick. Like, is it feminist for lipstick? And it's like, it's a stupid conversation. Are we all wearing lipstick?
Yes. Oh, yeah, totally.
But I think that what's exciting is just like, it's like, this is all, you know, it's not an isolated incident that women's bodies are treated like sexual property. I have so many things to say about the fact that, you know, Trump was allowed to say whatever racist, xenophobic, Islamophobic things he wanted to say for ages, and it's like, oh, but he tried to grab a white woman's, you know, it's like, so anyway, that's a whole other thing. But
yeah,
I think that it's really important to see that it's all part of an interlocking set of problems that have to do with, you know, wage inequality, like the inavailability of childcare. I mean, all these political systems. So I guess being a good man, I feel like this is what I was taking from what you were saying. It's saying stop talking about grabbing women by the, and it's also saying like we need to change the political systems that systemically, consistently disadvantage women, people of color, you know, LGBT people, all these different groups. It's not just about not saying the wrong thing.
Right.
It's about building greater socioeconomic equality.
Yeah. Well, so I've got just a couple more questions, but we will be taking questions from any and, well, not all of you, but any of you. And so if you have a question, go ahead and just line up at one of the mics. And again, the gentle reminder, just tell us who you are and end your statement with a question mark. Please, and if you could keep it as pithy as possible, we could get to as many people as possible. So before we start doing that, let me just ask you all, I'm curious about sort of how, since so much of your writing exists online, and like how that particular world plays into, or how you deal with I don't want to say the responsibilities, but in a way, the consequences of being a very a strong, opinionated woman in the digital world, because you've had to confront, I mean, Linda, you talked about how you actually like to engage your trolls.
Sometimes.
But wish you didn't have to, because other, you know, it'd be nice if other people fought the fight too. But I'd just love to hear a little bit about that, because that is such a huge deal for so many women who are, women and men, and people who speak out, who are being driven away from these new sort of areas of the new digital commons that we have.
Yeah, I think that's by design. I think that the internet has tremendous power to connect people, to give marginalized people a voice on a scale that they previously haven't had access to. And I think it's not a coincidence that internet trolling is disproportionately aimed at those people. Because, you know, I feel as a feminist and as a fat woman and as a, you know, a woman fighting for progressive causes, I am relentlessly targeted. And it's not a joke and it's not a game. It's an effort to make me shut up and to drive me out of that space because I'm being heard and I'm actually getting through to people. So I, you know, whatever you can do, if you're feeling, and I feel this every single day, like, why do I go on Twitter? Like, why do I just pour funny jokes into this machine that just gives me hate and garbage back? You know, but I think it is, I'm still in a place where I do think that it has significance and potential to make a difference. So if you're feeling like you can't stand it and it's too frightening, and people tell me this, like, that they're frightened. Like, I get emails all the time, like, oh, I want to be online, I want to become a writer, but I'm afraid because I've seen the backlash that other writers have faced. I mean, like, you know, I get death threats, I get rape threats, or more often, you're too fat for me to want to rape you, to which I always reply, could you please release a list of the people that you do want to rape, because I think that the police would like to see it. Like, that's not a good burn, man. But anyway, just whatever you can do to hang in there. Like, I block hundreds of thousands of people. There are amazing tools where you can just mass block, like, known trolls. And it's incredible. And it's the only thing that makes that service usable. And I think it's really worth it to have diverse voices on the internet. And if we let them drive us out, then they win. So mass blocking, solidarity, find communities with other people who think the same things that you do, and build each other up, and, you know, keep going. Yeah. Also, button up your online security, like any kind of two-step verification. Get your address off of whitepages.com, because it's up there, by the way. Anyway, just keep yourself safe, but keep writing, is what I say to people.
So I'm one of the fortunate ones in that I don't get as much hate as, like, Lindy. Lindy's mentions are in shambles all the time. And I'm like, what? One thing that happened, there was a time when people realized that, so first of all, being a woman online and being loud, already people are gonna come for you. And then when you're a woman of color, it's like an extra layer of people coming for you because you stop just being a bitch. They add the end to it. And so there was an experiment that was done. 1 week, black women on Twitter were like, hey, white men, y'all don't really believe when we say we're being targeted. How about this? Let's switch avatars for a week. Let's just switch avatars, nothing else, for a week. And you see the difference in what responses you get. And literally, the men were like, holy smokes. I have not tweeted differently. I haven't said anything different from what I would normally say, but the hate is like 10 times, just because of the avatar change. So I think it's just really important to, one, take care of yourself when that happens, because you will get the hate. I've gotten huge backlash for it. I'm not saying I've never done it, but, like, not like her, all the day, all every day, every single day.
It's my cool life.
Honestly, when that happens, I usually get text messages from people who are like, log off. Just log off for the day and consider the internet dead today. Okay, you just have to log off for the day. Yes, take those steps to be vigilant. Remove your address from everything. If you buy URLs, don't use your home address attached to that URL.
That's how they
find
you.
Because that's the first thing they'll use to find you. So if it's a PO box, use that. Business address, something that's not that. The two-step factor authentication is important beyond words, because so many people have been hacked. Their accounts have been hacked, and because this is what they're going to do, they're going to target you. You have to also ensure that nobody else but you have your password. Like, these are the simple things that you think are simple until you find out how somebody gets hacked, and you're like, really? 8 people had your password and you didn't know who the breach was from. And honestly, just understanding that it comes awfully with the territory. Like, don't make it stop you from doing the work that you find that's important. If you wake up thinking about doing this work and you don't do it because of one awful man, they're winning. So unfortunately, we have to like push past it, take the breaks that you need to take, but come back. Yeah. Because they can't shut us all up, okay? So we're gonna have to keep being yelling and loud and being shrill, yeah. All right?
Yeah, I think it's so important, and it's hard because I'm sure I haven't, you know, I don't have as many followers as either of you. I'm sure I get less of it, but I get it too, and it's so upsetting. I remember the first time, I think it says feminist in my Twitter bio, and I think I tweeted something that didn't even have anything to do with that, and some man started sending me photos of like fetal tissue, like aborted fetal tissue, and I was like, how unhappy and angry is this man that he's sending me, like, because of a joke I made on Twitter, these photos? And I think it's an ugly, ugly, dark place, but at least for me, so I'm very sympathetic to this sort of like the need for self-care and the need to step mm-hmm. back, but at least for me, I try to remember that it's like the same way little girls are warned about getting raped or like about getting pushed out of public space. I remember the first time it occurred to me, and it wasn't even that long ago, that I was like, oh, men travel and like go to places by themselves or like go out at night and aren't afraid of getting raped. Like, imagine being able to just walk around in public space, yep. not being afraid of that.
Yeah.
It's incredible. These are all systems of violent oppression that have the same effect, and we all want to protect ourselves, but it's important to recognize that, like, that asshole, excuse me, I'm sorry, Mom, that guy who's sending me these fetus pictures, it's just the same shit of trying to crowd women out of the public sphere, and so totally agree with you guys. It's like, find your coven, mm-hmm. find your crew, and do your work.
Yeah. So, questions.
Hi, I'm Hannah Vilhauer. Thank you guys so much for being here. I hear and read in all of your works like tools for advocating and amplifying oneself in the social and digital spheres. My question is, for those of us who are not as high on the food chain in professional capital, what are your suggestions for advocating and standing up to microaggressions in the workplace without being the squeaky wheel and being the little girl who's crying sexism every day?
I mean, it's hard. It's really hard because what I want, you know, instinctively what I want to tell you is like, just do it, just go for it. But it's not that easy. And there really is a very effective system in place to keep you from being that sort of tedious feminist scold. And it's because it still can impact your employment and your upward mobility and the way that people treat you at the office. And so it's not so easy. And I hate to, this is the trap that we've been in for decades, where it's like, okay, well, like, you have to, like, if you're going to complain, you have to be really nice and, like, bring in cookies and then, like, beg for respect, you know, like, beg for scraps of respect. And I don't know that we've figured out a great system, like, a great alternative yet, except for, you know, people who feel like they can take it and are willing to take the risk to, like, start the tide and push through and just be that person and see what happens. So, I don't know, I mean, if there's a way for you to maybe communicate with the other women in your office, see if you're having common experiences, and go to HR or to your boss together collectively, mm-hmm. I think that's a good idea. Does anyone else have any suggestions?
Yeah, I think everyone probably says this, and it's easier said than done, but finding mentors too, like female mentors and people who can support you, is such a godsend, and I think that probably everyone else is more sophisticated than me, but I remember the first moment I sort of connected to an older woman in my field, and we had these conversations, and I was like, oh, right, this stuff that happens, where, like, you know, your boss kind of flirts with you a little bit, or, like, this messed up other thing happened. It's like, that's systemic. That's not your personal fault. And I think that revelation where when, at least when I was younger, it was like, oh, I must have personally messed up something that this is happening to me. You didn't. And it's like, it's helpful. At least I think it's, if it's possible, it's really helpful to find older women in your field or women who you can connect with and talk about those issues with.
And I would just also add, I mean, your question was about being lower on the food chain, but I would say that for both young women and men who might be listening to this, as you rise on that food chain and you become more senior in whatever organization, set the tone, set the example, make it clear that certain things are not appropriate or, you know, the part of the culture of the organization and lead. So, because, you know, in the future, there's no reason why future older managers or senior people should be behaving like those of the present or the past, I'd say. Since there are two microphones, I'm going to bounce back and forth, okay? So way back there.
I'm Julie, and it's a perfect segue because I'm at least two decades older than the super women on the stage. And I would say, especially given the advice we just heard, as you go up the food chain, stand up, set the tone. But how realistic is that? And you, as saying, look for older mentors, what is their real experience? I would just say, having gone up the food chain, having been the one who always says, what about this elephant in the room, that it hasn't been a pretty picture. And the fact of being of a rising decade is very much a part of it. So it's so inspiring to hear what you have to say. I'd love to hear sort of more in depth if you can address the experiences of mentors.
I am really blessed to have a lot of mentors because I think the power of not having to reinvent the wheel is important. Two, getting the guidance can save you a bunch of mistakes that you'll make. Here's the thing about women also. This panel is called Superwomen. We assume we have to do everything ourselves, and that's not true, and actually it's a burden on us. You hear Superwomen, you're like, oh my God, that person does 18 million things. She's a mom, she's an executive, she's Superwoman, she does it all. No, she's exhausted. She's tired of being the person who has to like have it all together. She's tired of having all the answers. So I lean on my mentors. My book tour that's been going on in the last 5 weeks has been heavily pushed forward because my mentors have been like, who do you need to talk to? What rooms do you need to be in? We will make sure you're in those rooms. So the idea that you have to do everything yourself, the idea that you're on a stage because purely from your own work is false. It's because women who are powerful, more powerful than you are speaking your name up in rooms that you never even understand and exist. So seeking out mentors, one, it's not the idea of also emailing somebody saying, hey, be my mentor. That's not how I got any of my mentors. All my mentors are people who I somehow met at something, we connected, we stayed connected, we built this relationship. So it became where I knew I could go in a room or I could send them a text message and say, hey, I need this right now. Hey, I'm in your city. Hey, Lindy, what's up? Do my Seattle tour stop if you're available. And it's the organic relationship of knowing that you can tap on this person. They are invested in you too, okay? So people, just find guides. Find superheroes who can be your superhero when you need them. Find the people who you can call on and say, hey, how can I handle this situation? Give me the exact way you would handle this.
And I think also, because I don't, I think even if you don't have a one-on-one personal relationship with a mentor, a thing that I try to do with my work, like I think of my work as very performative. Like everything that I do is public. I'm on Twitter. You can see me interacting with people. You can see me confronting, you know, sexist
trolls.
I hate the word troll, but yeah. You know, and that was really helpful for me just knowing that, you know, when I was a younger writer, knowing that there were women who had succeeded and who were, you know, had risen to the top of their field, and just their existence made me understand that it was possible and made me stay in the job. So I think, I mean, I don't know. I just think that reading and paying attention and just if you're being present and public and visible is really helpful to younger people.
Yeah. No? Okay. Go ahead.
They're really short, so I'm going to do this. Hi, my name is Emma. I teach at a public middle school down in Jamaica Plain. Some of the strongest women that I've met in my life have been my own students. They're incredible examples. Watching them, especially I teach sixth grade, seeing them stand up to the boys that try to put them down. That said, they are at an age where they are starting to feel the weight of, dare I say, the patriarchy. And I'm wondering if you could recommend any works of literature that have either helped you find your own inner strength as women that you read as a child or read later in life that I could share with some of these girls that I kind of see on the brink of losing that strength.
One of my favorite books is Toni Morrison's Sula. And it's about, it basically tells the story of Sula, who's this like disruptive woman who just, everything she touches turns to ash. But then it also tells the stories about the women around her who kind of balance her out. That book, The Color Purple by Alice Walker, is a book that really focuses on the strength of womanhood in the face of men who try to basically break them. So that was an incredible book for me. So I'll say those two.
I gave my daughters, who are now 13 and 15, the Rookie yearbooks, you know, Rookie magazine, which are just these big anthologies of a lot of content written by teenage girls and written by older people, women and men, about being a teenager and in a really honest way. And I think those were really helpful in terms of people speaking to them in a contemporary language about contemporary issues.
I'm trying to think of something for sixth graders. I feel like my books, my awakening came later. I think when they get a little older, it's like, you know, the essays of bell hooks and Sylvia Federici and Angela Davis and I don't know, and Elena Ferrante novels, if they want to read novels. But I feel as if for me, those were the books that I was like, oh my God, when I was in my early 20s, but probably a bit much for the sixth grade.
I'll throw one in, if that's all right, because it's a book that my fifth grade teacher, who was actually a man, gave to me, and I read it every year. It's The Hero and the Crown. It's by Robin McKinley. It's in the fantasy realm, but the hero is the heroine, a young woman. She slays a dragon, and yeah. It's awesome.
Tamora Pierce. Tamora Pierce also. Yeah. Tamora Pierce, I forgot. So. Lady Knights. Yeah. Okay.
So we'll jump back. Thank you so much for your question. We'll jump back to the back.
Hi, I'm Sarah. My question is about words. Lindy, I really appreciate that you are willing to call yourself fat, because I think whenever I do that, people are like, oh no, you're not fat. And what they mean is, you're not ugly, you're not unlovable, because I mean, my stomach is what it is, that's a fact. So how important are these words? As writers, do you think that getting the vocabulary exactly right is important, or do we risk getting kind of bogged down in picayune details and missing the big picture?
I mean, I think words are tremendously important. God, I said tremendous like three times tonight, which is such a Trump thing, and it's making me... okay.
It's big league.
Words are bigly important, and... no, you know, they are and they aren't. You know, I for me personally, just, you know, talking about the word fat, I think it's the idea of reclaiming terms, which is... something that happens across social justice movements, words that have been used to hurt us and to diminish us, taking those back and redefining them for ourselves is really, really powerful. And so for people who say that words don't mean anything, I mean, coming to the point where I could call myself fat was probably the most important journey I ever took in my life. You know, saying, okay, because I know that this descriptor applies to me, and I know that it's mostly used as a pejorative, but what if I could separate those two things and turn it back into a descriptor, like tall or blonde? You know, it's not just semantics. It's powerful, and it's really, really meant something to me. It's changed the way that I have have moved through the world and have been able to advocate for myself and have been able to achieve success. So I think anyone that tells you that, I mean, anyone who really loves literature, I don't know how you could argue that words are meaningless or stories are meaningless, because they're everything to me.
One of the things I'm known for is my glossary of terms. So once you know some rules, you can break them and bend it. And I have fun with the English language by creating some words or spelling words somehow like I say them. So one of the words that I have changed the way a lot of people say them, and I am not apologizing for it, take it, is the word outfit. Yes. So like, if you read my blog, odds are you can't even say outfit anymore. You have to say outfit. A-L-P-H-E-T. Because that one person on Twitter one day thought that was an actual way to spell outfit. And I was like, oh, snap, he was serious. And then I took it on, and now I say outfit all the time, and now you can't stop saying outfit. Take that. Honestly, I think it's important to have fun with words and realize that sometimes we give words a lot of power, and then sometimes they bog us down because of it. And sometimes we just need to, like, take them apart, you know, and deconstruct English and have fun with it. For me, it's part of the writing process to do that. So, you know, my glossary that is ever expanding is proof that you can actually do that. And when new people find my blog, sometimes they're like, can you not spell? And I was like, literally, I use only 4 made-up words out of 800. Are you serious? Yeah.
Yeah, I always think literature starts, you know, if we go back to, like, cave people times, I don't know, but it's like it starts as spells, right? Like, words have power, and I think they absolutely can have socially transformative power, whether it's calling things out and not letting people get away with being like, oh, it's just words, you know, mm-hmm. It's just locker room banter. It's like, on the one hand, very important to recognize the power of language for evil, but also for good and for these sort of like creative uses. So yeah, I just totally would second what you guys are saying.
Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Victoria Weinstein, and I have a tiny social media presence compared to you guys. I'm a clergy person, so I'm a woman with that weird expectation identity layered on top of all the other things that women are supposed to be. I blog as Peace Bang, and I have a blog called Beauty Tips for Ministers, where a lot of what I talk about is being fat and polished and have an image that you're in control of. So first, I just want to thank you, so all of you, like, you have gotten me through for a long time. You have gotten me through, and I share columns and writings with my sisters and with friends. And my sister, by the way, Lovey, says, tell her I love her, I love her. So I had to do that.
Yay.
I want to talk about using humor subversively and claiming that, like, mocking tone in this way that is so powerful. I have peed my pants. I got to tell you, you've ruined some pants, man.
Put that on LinkedIn.
You know, seriously, like, oh my God. So I wanted to talk to you about claiming that ridicule in that powerful way, and how you do it and how you stay with it, because it's such a not a thing that good girls do. Thank you.
I don't know if I've ever been considered a good girl. I just realized, I was like, oh, wait, my first line, I curse in the church. Oh, so sorry, Jesus. We're going to talk about it tonight. I think it's really, first of all, I think humor is a powerful tool for social change. One, when you hit people with humor, their defenses are down. So then you can hit them with then what's important after that, because they were like, ha, got you. My writing is just who I am in real life, and I am this person in real life who tries to find humor in things. And I also think humor is really pointing out the absurdity of the world. So what I've really been doing in my writing for the last 13 years is pointing out what is completely weird. So I wrote a piece, and no matter what I talk about on my blog or even in my book, sometimes you laugh, and you're like, am I supposed to be laughing? I kind of wanted you to, because everything is so absurd, which is why I called it I'm Judging You, because the world is ridiculous. And one piece that I recently wrote was called like 10 things that I did longer than Betty Shelby spent in jail. So Betty Shelby is the cop who ended up killing Terrence Crutcher. Mm-hmm. She got into prison, they booked her at 1 o'clock. Like, she was considered arrested at 1 o'clock, and she was out by 1:11 a.m., 11 minutes. And this woman who killed somebody only spent 11 minutes in custody. And I wrote a piece about 10, like, waiting on an Uber took me longer. Because they always get lost. And you're like, dude, it's right here, right here. Like, trying to figure out what lipstick I'm wearing today took longer than that. Trying to pick out my shoes took longer than this woman who took a life. And in those moments, you're like, am I supposed to be laughing at this? Kind of, yes, because look around you. We're kind of living in a topsy-turvy world where a walking Cheeto's running for president. The entire thing is just, it's like J.K. Rowling wrote Harry Potter backwards. And that's the life that they were living in. So I really do think it's important. And that's why I mean, the shenanigans, I'm a fan of shenanigans. And you always laugh when I'm writing about anything, even if it's just like a slight bitter chuckle, because we've got to do better as a society, and the world is, we'll fix it slowly.
I think it changes the frame of reference, too. I mean, when we think about what humor does, I feel like it has the possibility that, you know, great modernist literature is also supposed to have of sort of defamiliarizing how we see reality and being like, oh, fuck, 11 minutes. I just had another bad
in
word.
In a church.
I'm so,
oh,
my
we're
mom
the worst. They didn't
I'm
tell
so
us.
Sorry, Mom. But that's the power of it, is that it's this way, as you said, of getting people's guard down and then being like, whoa, bang, look how messed up this situation that we take completely for granted in some cases is. And so I think it's an incredibly powerful tool that
it's
way.
It's also a coping mechanism. Right. You know, I mean, when I write about, I write in my book about, you know, a lot of traumatic experiences, and all those chapters are funny. All those chapters have jokes in them, because I don't know any other way to cope with with darkness.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people are like that, and it's a really, it's a really great way to communicate with other people. I don't know. I mean, sometimes it's like the sadder something is, the funnier my writing will end up being about it, because it's just like out of desperation to feel something that's not just despair.
Besides despair, yeah. Well, I'm sure the people waiting at the microphone are feeling a little bit of despair at the moment, because we are out of time.
No!
But Lindy West, Lovey Ajayi, and Maura Weigel, thank you so much
for
being here. And for-